one patient who was really suffering from anxiety and lots of stuff. And I remember just looking at her and being like, have you ever considered Cambo? And then I heard what I was saying and I was like, oh no, this is it. This is the moment. I've just recommended a weird Amazonian frog poison to my NHS patient. And I was like, right, it's time to leave now.
Welcome back to the Mojo Podcast, a place for curious minds to fill up on leadership, inspiration, and hear wonderful stories of mojo, lost and found, high and low. I'm your host, Richard Stokes, and we meet here to spend time with a diverse and brilliant group of guests who have been generous to spend their time with me. And as we close the sixth series, we've been reflecting on commitment, a concept we all understand, but that can prove elusive, even fearful for us. In this series, we've gone under the skin of commitment, how we can commit to ourselves, to our values, our purpose, and the payoff we see when we literally choose not to have any more choice. Commitment is one of life's beautiful paradoxes. It's been a privilege to have these powerful and vibrant conversations with amazing guests from the arts, business, sport, adventurers, influencers, pioneers. Everyone has brought something new and fresh. So do have a listen back to the previous nine conversations. To complete the series, I have a fabulous guest for you with her own profound story of change, consciousness, and commitment. And her shift really was a massive life pivot from medical doctor to medicine woman.
4 years I was the Cambo practitioner and the A&E doctor, which made me the crazy frog lady to my emergency medicine physicians and the, oh my gosh, you're a doctor, to the kind of hippie, like new age healing scene.
Alex Pardy is a medical doctor turned medicine woman with a passion for men's work and worldwide systems change, using the tools of plant medicine, shamanism, and coaching.
After ayahuasca, I suddenly had this map of being able to feel what felt true to me or what felt alive in my system. Whereas before it was just, is this a good idea? Rationalize, rationalize, rationalize.
Check out the show notes for links to Alex's Instagram and email where you can find out much more. This is a really fascinating conversation, full of story and wisdom and interest, and I hope you love it. Over to my Mojo conversation with Alex Pardy. So, welcome back to the Mojo Podcast. I know it's been a bit of a break, but it's fabulous to be back here with my last guest of the current series. And we're going over to the Somerset, Wiltshire area of the UK. And I'm talking to Alex Pardy. Alex, how are you?
I'm great today. Thank you, Richard. Great to be on here.
Yeah, excited to have you on. And I always start here with my guests. So, I'll get a data point from you. Out of 10, how is your mojo today, Alex?
I would actually say my mojo is at about an 8, but if you'd asked me yesterday, it would have been about a 3.
Oh wow. We might have to drill into that a little bit. That's a big jump. So is an eight first, is an eight, does that feel quite high for you or quite a normal place?
Absolutely not. That is quite a unique number based on one or two breakthroughs I had this morning. And so, yeah, it's been a bit of a lull for a while, actually, and I do find that with the mojo. It's a mysterious creature, almost like the creative muse who will come and just be like, yes, here is the idea you've been waiting for and that you can run with. So I feel like that's happened for me today.
Oh, beautiful. And we're very naturally easing into what my next question would be is what mojo, this word, this essence means to you?
That's a really juicy one. And it's really interesting because when I accepted this podcast interview, I didn't actually know the name of your podcast. And I was really grinning from ear to ear when I saw it because I almost used mojo as one of the main words in my branding and messaging, and I didn't actually. So it's a really important thing to me. And I feel like it's that kind of flow with the universe. It's feeling like you're in flow with life as opposed to viewing it from the outside. And that often aligns with feeling like there's something to run with, so a purpose or a direction or an eros, you could call it, a kind of I'm turned on by life right now. And when that's gone, almost everything is gray. You could be eating a really wonderful meal or in a beautiful place, but it just doesn't land the same. So it's a very important thing for me.
Wow, I love, well, this obviously we were brought together by this essence, this word mojo. So pleased to hear that it means so much for you and just how you see it. I'm up to about 90 episodes now, and honestly, nobody has said the same thing twice, which is why I love this exploration and this early question of what mojo means, to this flow with life. And I love how you couple that with this sense of purpose, this sense almost with action. There's something that's going to go with it, and the counterpoint to it as well. You could be in the most beautiful place, most beautiful people, beautiful food, but if your mojo's low, the sense of colorlessness that you talk about, this grayness that comes through. Wow. Okay. Well, thank you for bringing that to the show. And Alex, before we dive in, so I obviously know a little bit about you. We've met over in Ibiza a few months ago. What would be useful for listeners now, if they don't know you so well, to get the most out of this conversation that we're going to have? What do they need to know?
Well, there's two things that are coming to the fore. One is that I have various lenses that I see reality through. And one of those is the Western medical lens as an ex-medical doctor, which I left that profession 8 years ago now. And I was a doctor for 6 years. The other is a shamanic lens, or a more animist philosophical lens, where I believe that everything is conscious and that we can communicate with it. And that's a very different lens from most of modern humanity's existence, daily life. And the third thing, is as a coach, I'm really focused on solutions-focused conversations, ideas, ways of living, and action. And often when we come to shamanic healers, which is something I've also trained in, or when we come to our knees by life, when we come to these midlife crises or these moments, often when we talk about healing work, it's with the lens of looking backwards. But as a coach, combined with the shamanic healing work, to me, it's all about looking forwards. What are we creating? And so that's often a lens I'm going to bring for most people.
That's wonderful. I get these three key elements, parts of your life, which I guess shape you, your outlook, and how you support and how you're in service of people. I would love, to get into this. Obviously, there was a big shift for you at some point, and in that I mean from medical doctor to medicine woman, as you describe it, which obviously happened. And I think, for listeners, I think there'll be some fascination to that, because, as you said, they seem to be a long way apart, those worlds, and you have straddled them, and you have chosen, I think, if I'm getting this right, to leave or spend less time in one and spend more time in another realm. What was going on for you there? So, because I know another thing we have in common, actually, I believe you studied at Leeds University.
I did.
I was also there a little bit before you, but I did check out your LinkedIn before we talked. So I guess you were doing all your medical studies there. And I remember I had a lot of friends who were medics, and the intensity of it, and the hours, and obviously the years compared to most of us doing other arts-based degrees. So a lot of commitment, a lot you put into that, and then you shifted. Could you just talk to me a little bit around some of those choices? Were there key moments where things happened?
So, this story doesn't sound a lot like people will expect it to. Not that there's much like expectation. However, I think a lot of people project this kind of saint-like quality onto doctors. Like, they have this almost godlike aura of being there in the moment of life and death for someone. And it's a big thing. However, what calls a lot of people to medicine is often not altruism. It's family history, it's social prestige, it's financial, there's so many things. And actually, for me, it was the death of my father when I was five, and never knowing him, but knowing that he was a doctor, and knowing that his father died when he was five, and he was also a doctor, and that my great grandfather was also a doctor. And as the first born in my family, which in shamanic terms is often considered the one who takes on the patriarchal lineage energetically, have no recollection of ever thinking about becoming a doctor. But when, I don't know if anyone has this anymore in the modern schooling system, but at the age of 16 or 17, someone comes around and you do this careers test. It's really funny, and almost everyone gets town planner. I've actually met one town planner of my life.
I know some town planners.
Oh my God, I love it. Everyone got town planner. I don't even know what that is. But yes, and so I remember doing this careers test. I was like, I don't think I want to be a town planner. And they asked me, like, well, what do you want to do? And of course, you had to know at the age of 17 what you wanted to do with your entire life. And I just said, I'm going to be a doctor. And it was completely out of the blue. And I think now, looking back in terms of a constellations piece, I think I had taken on like an energetic baton from my father's lineage. And that's a lot of around why I do men's work now, actually, which we'll go into, I'm sure, later. Yes, it was a lot of it was really familial and also to do with just not knowing what else to do. And then I was kind of on a treadmill of education and I never really connected to the depth of what I was doing. If I'm really honest, I just wasn't connected to it. And so I kind of went on the treadmill, never took a gap year, went into uni, just worked. Everyone always says, gosh, wasn't that a lot of work? But to me, it was all I'd ever known. It was just the educational treadmill. And so I then emerged as a doctor. And honestly, I was just a bit surprised. I was like, oh my gosh, I've finally got to this place where I'm not in education anymore at the age of 24. And I've got to do something. And yeah, then followed 2 years of intense distress when my stepfather was diagnosed with bowel cancer at the same time that I went into my first rotation as a colorectal surgical GYN doctor. And it was all just a bit too much. And so what happened after my junior doctor years was I went traveling and unexpectedly found ayahuasca. Now, I'm not sure how many of your listeners know about this psychedelic brew from the Amazon jungle, but it kept finding me. And what happened was I drank this brew and had a massive 180 degree turn from scientific reductionist atheist to, oh my gosh, energy is real. These hippies are onto something. I've got a lot to learn and I don't really know anything actually. And really, the last 11 years of my life have been integrating that experience and my own healing journey into how disconnected I was. And how many parts of me needed healing, and then sharing that with anyone else who is feeling drawn.
Well, Alex, thank you for sharing that. There are most elements of that I didn't know about. So in terms of the obviously the family history and your father passing at that really tender age, and obviously what that, taking all that on. And then, what I can relate to in that is the educational treadmill that we kind of attach ourselves to, whether we know what we're going to do or not. But I can imagine, coming out like, okay, here I am. I've got all these qualifications. Now this is what I'm going to do. And then so the ayahuasca experience, did that take place? Was that something in the UK you went looking for? You were traveling, right? You were traveling at this point. So were you searching for
No.
this different way of looking at the world?
No. Well, as we just discussed, we both went to Leeds University, and Leeds was really renowned as a party university, wasn't
Oh
it? It was
yes.
a
Oh
bit of a
yes.
party vibe. And it actually took me till my 3rd year of medical school to discover recreational drugs, which was quite late on. I was think about 20 at that stage. And so no, I was not looking for this medicine at all. I was at a party on a beach in Tulum, New Year's Eve 2012, at the so-called end of the Mayan calendar, which was never going to be the end of the world and was actually more of a demarcation of ages in the Mayan calendar system. And I happened across a couple of Argentinian brothers who gave me some ecstasy. And after a night of partying with them, they said, you have to come to an ayahuasca ceremony with us in 2 weeks. We're flying a shaman from Brazil up here, and we insist after spending 12 hours with you that you would insanely benefit from this substance. And I was like, no, I've heard about this. It cares if you eat pork. How can a plant care if you eat pork? It's really stupid. I'm not into it. And they said, no, categorically, you have to come. And so I said, okay. So it really found me. Yeah.
Yeah. So what I'm getting is this almost a sense of the hero's journey that you went on. It's often, finding these
guides or mentors who invite you. And that sounds like the invitation, and you accepted it, and everything, I guess, has unfolded from there. So you drank the brew. We're going to get more into the benefits, the experience of this shortly. Did that immediately have the effect of, I need to switch and get out of what I've trained so hard for and I've been doing, or did it sort of happen over time?
It then took another 4 years because I had nowhere to go. I was vocationally trained in something and I didn't know anything else. And so it was actually a few months later that I again, pressed by these Argentinian men, went down to the jungle to go and do a 10-day dieta, which is where you drink ayahuasca every other day for 10 days, so five times, and have to drink a liter of tea of a specific plant that you were dieting with to understand and receive its guidance and intuition in your dream time, which at the time I had no idea what I was doing. I only learned this years later. They didn't really explain anything when I was there. And at that time, I then discovered something called Cambo, which was a frog poison from the Amazon jungle. And our shaman said, does anyone want Cambo? And I didn't understand what it was. But at that stage, I was like, whatever you have, I don't want any more of it. I'm done. I need to go away and just, you know, write a lot of letters, contemplate my navel and integrate this experience, because it was wild. It was like going from, like I said, atheist reductionism, nothing's real in all these nonsense religious ways. And then to genuinely being like, wow, energy, conscious entities outside of myself are real. What does this mean? And so I went back to London and didn't really think about plant medicine for a while, until a friend of mine who ironically is an accountant from London told me that there was a Cambo ceremony happening in Deptford, of all the places, of all the weird places in the world.
Southeast London, of course.
Cambo ceremony in Southeast London. And this was 2015, so no one really knew about Cambo, which is a medicinal secretion from the back of a frog in the Amazon. No one really knew about it back then. There was like a handful of practitioners in the UK. And so I was like, I remember the shaman mentioning that word. And so I went and I looked it up and I discovered it was a frog. Me being a doctor went to the PubMed website, which is where all the medical publications are gathered. And I typed in the Latin name of the frog and I found a whole slew of research papers on the science of the peptides contained within the secretion. And I was honestly blown away by specifically the antibacterial aspects of this medicine, which are profound. It kills MRSA, it kills all kinds of drug resistant strains of bacteria, which as a doctor I was seeing was such a big issue, you know, big, big issue of people dying from MRSA and even drug resistant syphilis strains emerging in North England when I was a medical student. And so I just decided to train in it just in case antibiotics became less effective.
Right.
Yeah.
And this is alongside your day-to-day medical work. I'm going to take on this other modality, I guess we might call it, this new learning.
So I never intended to actually hold Cambo circles, which is where you gather with a few people and administer this medicine. It's a short process, sort of 2 to 3 hours. That's actually where I met Danny, who I know you've been.
Our mutual friend, yes. Yes.
And Danny and I did the same Cambo training. However, it just happened that all the skill sets I had from being a singer in the school choir, from learning certain energy healing techniques a few months before that this Cambo opportunity appeared, all of it just coalesced into actually making me quite a skilled facilitator with this medicine. And so for 4 years, I was the Cambo practitioner and the A&E doctor, which made me the crazy frog lady to my emergency medicine physicians and the, oh my gosh, you're a doctor, to the kind of hippie, like new age healing scene. And it was a really interesting bridge to walk for a while, yes.
Love that. The identities we get. Crazy frog lady who's in A&E. She'll fix you up and then she'll talk to you about Cambo at a later date. Okay, so then... Just to sort of round it off then with the former self and the Western medical element, was there a line in the sand, I guess, at some point said, well, that's it. I'm now done with that. And I need to fully embrace and commit to this new world.
Yes, it was one night. I remember it well. I think it was about 2 a.m. in winter in Southmead Emergency A&E. And it was one patient who was really suffering from anxiety and lots of stuff. And I remember just looking at her and being like, "Have you ever considered Cambo?" And then I heard what I was saying and I was like, "Oh no, this is it. This is the moment. I've
This is
just
the moment.
recommended a weird Amazonian frog poison to my NHS patient." And I was like, "Right, it's time to leave now." Yeah.
Wow, but it's fascinating to get to the, almost that point of maximum pivot, which was sounds like it was at that point for you. And then where, you know, as you said, you knew nothing else. You're vocationally very well trained and now more experienced in this area, being a doctor. How did you then go and create what you've created? And we'll get into that in terms of what you do and how you support people as a shamanic healer, as a coach. What were your first kind of steps into it? I guess I'm, what were the fears there, if there were some, and how did you overcome those?
Now, this is the thing that a lot of people actually really would like to learn from me, but I can't convey because it's not necessarily courage. I would think it's probably veering on an ADHD kind of fickleness that actually means I don't experience much fear in my life. I tend to just do things which I'm strongly moved to do and which I have a lot to thank to ayahuasca because before ayahuasca, I really was what I call a head on a stick. I had no connection to the somatic awareness of what was happening in my belly, in my solar plexus. And after ayahuasca, I suddenly had this map of being able to feel what felt true to me or what felt alive in my system. Whereas before, it was just, is this a good idea? Rationalize, rationalize, rationalize. And there was no body wisdom online. And really, what just happened was and often I don't receive a full yes to something, like that's what I need to do. It's more of like a no, that's what I really don't want to do. And from there, I'm like, well, what are my options? And I start to move towards something else. So I actually let my excitement guide me. And due to this Sagittarian optimism and fickleness, I tend to just go and do it and then maybe have regrets later. So I'll tell you what happened next was I then spent 6 months training as a health coach with the Health Coach Institute. And it seemed like a very natural segue away from Western medicine to go into health coaching. But I very quickly realized that, helping middle-aged women lose weight was just not my thing. And actually, I was much more into people who were about to embrace or go through massive life shifts, which is essentially what had happened to me in my own life and what was happening again through the decision to leave medicine and support people to courageously move through things themselves. And so actually what then happened was there were a few years of not quite enough clients, not quite knowing how to market and not realizing the tens of dozens of skill sets that an entrepreneur or someone striking off on their own actually needs and requires in the modern day and age. So it was a struggle. There was struggle for a few years. And as you know, after COVID and with this modernization of so many things and a decreased sense making in so many areas for a lot of humanity, it's never easy and completely okay actually as an entrepreneur and a sole agent in this work. But yeah, things are a lot better now, a lot better.
Thank you. And that sense of, you talked about it, that the head on a stick. I think about the head bubble that most of us spend a lot of our time in. And certainly when you're, I think it is in those, perhaps it's in a marker of those professions where, being up there in your head is a sign of success. That's where you should be. You should be thinking with your brain, dare I say, not with your heart and your gut. How could you possibly make decisions with those other parts of your body? But as we know, and you know extremely well, that gives you that hard no to things, and that this is going to be a yes. I'm gonna follow that. Where have you followed? What have you found along this flowing journey of yours that's really worked for you? In this, yes, I completely empathize with that. It's tough out there as an entrepreneur creating your thing, especially and maybe this is my view of it, when your thing is not so well known about? Is that fair to say?
Well, that was actually a lot of what drove me at the start, was my own incredibly profound 180 degree shift after this plant medicine. Really, I just wanted to destigmatize it as a doctor. I saw my place as such a valuable role for others to walk that path, was to say, look, it's actually been really great. And it's not all gonna make holes in your brain and all the other stupid stories that go around about plant medicine. It's actually a wonderful thing. And so there was a lot of harm reduction and education and permission giving, which is what I initially saw my role as. However, I would actually say in the last, well, since 2018, psilocybin, the active compound of magic mushrooms, which is more the medicine of these lands and more culturally known outside of the Amazon, it's had massive research done on it in King's College London, and Imperial College as well have done a lot of research on this substance. And it almost seems to be in every weekend paper that I've read recently. There's another article about how it's helping anorexia, depression, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah.
Yeah. And am I right in saying in the UK, at least, it remains an illegal substance? Right. Yeah. And I know in other countries like the Netherlands, it's more, I don't know if it's legal, decriminalized at least. But so how do you find ways to work with that in a way that you can make work, I suppose? If this thing that you know, that I know, I've experienced it too, is immensely powerful and does a lot of good, but it's been classed as bad, want of a better word.
Class A, Schedule One.
Well, yeah. There we go. Yeah. Top of the list.
Really top of the list. Well, I mean, when we were at Leeds University, I don't know if you remember that little shop on Hyde Park Corner that used to sell mescaline and mushrooms. Well, that was a Class C at that stage. That was a Class C. So what happened was, I believe it was 2007, the government rescheduled or reclassified, as we say in the UK, psilocybin from a Class C to a Class A, which now means possession is akin to having heroin or some other cocaine. And if you were to deal in it, it would, you know, potentially lead to a very serious sentence. So, I mean, I always talk about these things from an educational perspective. And that's really, no one can stop you from discussing something hypothetically.
Yeah.
And then really the work that I do with these substances is either always in the Netherlands, in Mexico, or on some soil where it is legal, or at least there's a gray area. Costa Rica, even Ibiza in Spain, in some areas, it's a lot less grave, the situation on Portugal, for example. So it's just making sure that we're covering ourselves in that way and making sure everyone feels safe. But really, no one can stop you talking about these things. And in fact, I think it's so important that I do put my neck on the line and make people aware of these substances. It's so important.
And you used the word earlier, you know, courage. And it feels like there is a significant amount of courage between talking around these things and making the information, as you say, the research that's out there now public and in the public realm. So people, you know, adults can make their own choices, perhaps, about these things. And as you said, you know, there are lots of therapeutic uses for things like psilocybin. I've so many people in my extended network are now talking about it as overcoming grief and deeply held trauma from their childhood. And it's making huge differences versus people have been in, for example, talk therapy for many, many years and not maybe got so far. Now, I'm not going to sit here and say one is better than the other, but I think it's interesting that there are other ways.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of like, I describe therapy. Well, let me describe plant medicine to me. It's almost like if you're, you know, when you pick up a big stone and there's an insect under it and it suddenly goes and looks at you like, oh my God, and there's light just pouring in, and it can be a bit shocking to that poor animal. I think of that as the subconscious. And often with these psychedelics, you're picking a stone up and you're just going, right, what's in Pandora's box? And it's like, the subconscious can sometimes be a bit like, oh my gosh, that was quick, or whoa, didn't expect that. And there's a good reason often that the subconscious is holding on to these things, because it threatens our ego construct. It threatens how we show up and function day to day. It keeps us calm at least on the exterior, and looking after, maybe we have dependents or a job or things that we need in our life to stay stable. However, we all know how if we don't pick up that stone and really like look something face on, that it's going to be running the show to the point where it's actually detrimental. The way I see therapy is that it's almost like you're chipping away the stone, and you may or may not get to the insect. Like, you're just slowly chipping away. And in a way, that's why therapy could maybe have longer lasting effects. If you do it for long enough and deep enough with someone you really resonate with, and you slowly get there, you've actually got all the somatic tools, you've got all the day-to-day sober ways of being with what's emerging for you, so that when you actually encounter that thing, then you can go away and you're like, actually, I know how to hold myself in the day to day, because I've touched this place many times over years. And so that is the one criticism of psychedelic experiences, that they're almost so fast that they can be re-traumatizing, and they're so sort of sudden that then we don't necessarily have those skills to go and integrate that on our own.
And that's a really important area that I wanted to touch on with you, this importance of working with someone with great experience, a great facilitator. As I said, I've had an experience with plant medicine, and had a great facilitator in our mutual friend, Danny. And I can't even imagine having that experience either by myself or with people who are just kind of having a go. And it feels like the importance of this leader, this facilitator is immense, right? In this space.
It's the same again as a therapist. If you don't resonate with that person, if their energy doesn't make you feel safe, if your left brain can't switch off, because that's the gatekeeper. If you're looking at this from an internal family systems perspective, you have this this protector who's just making sure that you're safe to do this, to go there, to relinquish the control. And it's often been in place for decades, all of our lives, from very early ages. And so if you're not feeling safe and you don't resonate with their ideologies, their paradigm, their language, then you need to find someone that your soul is a very deep yes to.
And let's move into, some of the work that you're doing. You've worked, so since the big pivot from traditional Western medicine to plant medicine, and you've created your business and all these services. Who are you calling to, and who's calling to you, and who's showing up? You talked about men's work, for example. So I'm fascinated to dive into that as an area.
It's really interesting. They say that your clients choose you, like your niche will find you. And when I first started my health coaching biz, it was really, like I said, there was this surreal feeling of like, this isn't me. And then strangely, sort of various men, often either about to retire or going through their midlife crisis, would find me. And those were the people I was delighting in supporting. And as a result of that, I went away and I did a lot of research on the masculine. What is the masculine? I read Iron John by Robert Bly. I read No More Mr. Nice Guy by Robert Glover. I read King Warrior Magician Lover, and all these books that really supported me to support my clients. But now, retrospectively looking back, I realized there was such a part of me in my masculine, and through the lack of my father, was yearning for this healing of my own inner masculine. It's been such a beautiful journey. And then the second part of that was actually going to all these healing classes, workshops, retreats, etc., and just seeing such a high proportion of women in comparison to men. And I was like, where the hell are all the men? Like, where are they? And I think it's so multifactorial why men don't necessarily come into these spaces. I've seen sometimes there are more men and sometimes there are less. I've seen an overall increase in men in these spaces, but actually it's not true. There's still more women after nearly a decade in this space, in these spaces, than there are men. And as a woman with sisters who are also women, and we're really longing for these men who are doing the work. And there are loads of them. I'm not saying there aren't any, but there's definitely more women than there are men in the space. And there's just a desire to bring men up, because I can only speak for myself as a woman. I do not want to speak on behalf of other women. But really, a man in his leadership, in his purpose, healed, providing, on purpose. It's just so important for everyone, for humanity at this moment on the planet, for women to be able to drop into their feminine and let go of this masculine hardness that so many of us have adopted. And I just, it's a thing that I come back to again and again that I feel so passionate about and seem very good at supporting men with, probably, like I've said, because of my own inner healing work around the masculine. And so the men I tend to attract are men who are working through a people-pleasing, nice guy archetype.
Yeah.
And that can express in so many ways, from, you know, being the guy who always seems to be the best friend but never gets the woman, or the guy who is very, very nice until they're not and suddenly there's a massive angry outburst, or the guy who, yeah, just keeps on not getting the promotion. There's a very classic archetype, and I'm not saying that there aren't men who have expressions of this archetype in positions of power and leadership, but it seems to be that when there's an aspect of this that is unhealed, then they will keep coming up against a glass ceiling that they cannot move beyond. And that's the kind of man that comes to me. And that's when I'm like, right, let's fix this. Let's go in.
Yeah. Amazing. I love, yes, those clients being absolutely drawn to you. It's a resonance that I'm sure that you are giving out, conscious, unconsciously, that's being received. And typically, you know, I suppose getting slightly practical with it, what might someone experience then? Because I think, again, a lot of what you're talking about is the education of this and demystifying. And, you know, if someone's listening to this and going, well, that, you know, that that people-pleasing man who's creating all these limitations on himself, well, that sounds a bit like me. What would I do? How do I step forward and work with someone like you, Alex?
Well, you know, I don't recommend, and this is actually one thing I was going to say at the very start of this podcast. You're like, what do people need to know about you? And I was going to say that I don't know anything. And it's kind of this joker, jester, or in the Lakota tradition, they call it the Hayoka, the kind of coyote. It's this kind of, I've always been a bit of a rebel, and I like to, you know, sometimes say the unexpected thing. And, you know, I would suggest that a man really sits back and feels into if I'm the right person for him, because a lot of men would say, don't work with a woman if you want to do men's work, work with a man. And this is, it's an interesting point to make. And I would suggest that a man sits back and decides, you know, are my issues with men? Are my issues with women? How was I most traumatized as a child? Was it from rejection and abandonment from my mother, or was it from my father? Do I have many healthy male relationships? Do I have many healthy female relationships? And through that, you can start to stratify who might be the right person for you, because really a really great place for all men to start is a men's group. Now, I just feel that if men do not have healthy male relationships, which is another core trait of the nice guy, then that is the most important place for you to start. If maybe you didn't receive the nurturing and the mother energy that you needed as a young boy or man, then coming to a woman could be a great place for you. And you know, a lot of men don't feel safe around other men. And if that's the case, it could be a good thing for you to start with a woman. Similarly, if you've been abused by a male caregiver, abused by a male, then maybe start with a woman. But I always advise my clients to make sure that once they've finished working with me, or even alongside it, that they're working with a man or moving towards part of a men's group.
To do men's work, go to a man, seems to be the thematic that's kind of out there. And there are so many men who are, for whatever reasons, are resisting working with anybody. And, you know, what I would just love, this is partly why I do this podcast, it's I run a monthly men's group actually here in Ibiza. As much for me as the guys that come, is to have that moment of connection, communion, because we are, you know, it can get a bit isolated depending on the work you're doing, a bit stuck, priorities shifting. So yeah, calling men forward is absolutely something that we have in common. So yeah, if you're listening to this, as a man, just step forward. What can give? I guess this is more in general terms. We're on men now. The courage to do that. What would be would really draw? If you're sitting there and you, because I work with a lot of guys and they've been on the edge of the pool for some time, and the water looks lovely, but oh, Richard, if I jump in, I'm going to get wet. And yes, you will, but that's part of the process. So how do we, I guess it's the collective way, how do we get more men off the edge of the pool into the water?
You know, one of my mentors gave me this wonderful image once of a donkey. And he said, people are donkeys and they're either one of two donkeys. And some donkeys are motivated by a carrot on a stick, which you could just dangle right in front of them. And it's like, it's this really great thing I'm going to move towards. Oh my gosh, this carrot looks so good. And other people are the donkey that really respond well to a stick on their butt being hit as they go up the hill. And, you know, men, it's a really interesting thing because they're very different to women. And men often need that kind of smack. They need like a bit of a harsher jolt. And I don't know why that is. I haven't quite figured that out yet. Mm. So I would say that men need a long, hard sit down with themselves, and they need to look at what has happened so far in their lives. You know, are they pleasing their woman in bed? Have they been in the same stagnant job for a long time? And someone needs to just get real with them, and inside their own head, that is, they need to get real with themselves and say, has anything changed? Am I doing anything different? And if I carry on like this, nothing is going to change. Okay, great. What is the result of that moving forward? So this again is the coaching lens. What am I moving towards? And so I'd ask a man to look at his life for the last 3 years. What's he achieved? What's not working? And without support, what is the next 3, 5, 10 years really going to look like? If he stayed exactly where he is now, then how is he going to feel in 3 years? And if it's still like a little bit apathetic, a bit hopeless, a bit, you know, whatever, then get one of those charts, you know, that shows you how many weeks you have left in your entire life or however many months you have left in your life, and start counting it off. Because death comes for us all, and we do not know when that day will be. And I think this is one of the really beautiful aspects of Stoicism, which as a philosophy, I'm starting to really move towards now that I'm nearing 40. It's just that thing that age seems to ripen in one is that reality kind of, I'm not immortal anymore. I am moving towards midlife. You know, this is real. And there's only a certain amount of time if we're lucky. And to put that chart on his wall and start crossing it off. And yeah, hopefully that's going to shift something.
Well, there we go. Really practical action, which again, I think talks to the masculine as well. There's something practical I can do, something programmatic I can do. And this sense of, I get a sense of, you know, really think about consequences. If consequence of doing nothing, you know, and then there's this sort of idea of the pain and the possibility. There's this is just going to be painful, or there's this possibility of change and development and rebirth that sits there for us.
I think, you know, we can pretend that we're comfortable where we are, but if we get really real with ourselves, then we can see the amount of pain that comes from mediocrity and stagnancy, and the impact that has on our relationships, and that feeling of time slipping away. It's really intense if we allow ourselves to really be with it and look at it. And I know, because I've been there for months, if not years, at times in my life, and it's painful. It is so painful. So yeah, just be in that pain, be honest, and just remember you have this one incredible gift of life and the health that's in this body now. You're never going to be younger. You're never going to be any more healthy than this moment. So do something with it.
That's a beautiful, important sentiment. And I think as we sort of navigate towards sort of closing up, Alex, I wanted to also get a sense from you. We talked a bit about how you work, but how can people find out more about what you're doing? Are there things like retreats that you've got coming up that you can share with people? How do people find you?
I operate mainly on Instagram because, like I said, there's a real love of education, harm reduction, and giving value to people. And I find that that's the easiest, most accessible place for a lot of people. Hmm. I do not currently have a website. That's been in the works for about 5 years. And yes, I've just run a few events in Mexico, working with an indigenous elder on a pilgrimage to the land of the mushrooms up there. And but really, there's one thing coming up in the UK, which is actually non-psychedelic. However, it's working with the energy of oak, which is the tree of really these lands. It is the tree of the ancient druids, who were really the indigenous medicine keepers and shamans of these lands. And the oak tree is all about sovereignty. It's about service. It's really the energy of the king is the energy of oak. It's the of the master trees of this these lands. It's the king of the trees. And white birch is actually the grandmother, or the sort of feminine queen equivalent. And so I have an amazing teacher flying over from Austin, Texas, a man called Jordan Mockingbird. We're actually meeting in just under a month on the 27th of September. I know you said not to say dates, but okay. Right now.
That's good. That's the real time.
Just under a month, and yeah, we're going to be working with the spirit of tobacco, which is an incredibly grounding, protective, and healing plant to work with, and it acts as a conduit to help support us to talk to the spirit of the oak tree. So Jordan actually had a lot of autoimmune conditions and illness in his body physically, which he healed through this process of dieting with trees, which is a traditional Amazonian technique, which he's moved into working with more, let's say, northern, global north trees than, yeah. And anyway, he's an amazing facilitator in terms of divine masculine. The transmission he carries in terms of integrity and presence and the energy he carries in his being is something I feel all men should experience to be around. Mm. So that's going to be incredible. But if not, I'm sure that Danny and I are going to cook something up really soon in terms of retreats. So keep your eye open there. And then I do offer coaching and one-on-one work as a rolling thing. I'm currently about to open my practice for two new clients this fall. And yeah, that normally looks like 4, 6, or 8 month containers. And that often involves one-on-one work in person, as well as remote coaching and accountability. Because I feel accountability is the missing piece for a lot of people. It's like, mm-hmm. Oh, I wouldn't have had this transformational experience, great. And then you go away and somehow we expect ourselves to be these perfect accountable beings to ourselves. And then of course the old habits sneak in and then we get demoralized and even sometimes pile shame on ourselves for thinking we must know better and not doing better. And I find this can get exacerbated after something as expansive like a plant medicine experience. We're like, wow, I get it, I can do it. And then we go home and it's like, oh no, I'm still myself actually. And so I really love supporting people through actually implementing what it is they now understand. And it gives me great joy.
I see that, and that's really resonated and come through in our relatively short conversation. But Alex, amazing wisdom, the story that you shared, your story is fascinating. And I just know more people are going to want to find out more about you. We'll put all the links to your Instagram, for example, they'll be in the show notes so you can see those and get in touch. And so, yeah, Alex, thank you so much for joining the Mojo podcast today. Really appreciated it.
Oh, such a joy. I'll give you my email. I'll also give you, a few other points of contact too. And Richard, it's been such a pleasure. I'm really glad that we met in Ibiza those few months ago. And wishing you all the best.
What a fitting way to end Series 6 of the Mojo podcast, where we focused on commitment. And to be frank, my own commitment to this podcast wavered in parts.
shall I do it at all? Now I'm in it. Shall I carry on? And yes, there was a big gap towards the end. But you know what? I'm something of an upholder type. Check out Gretchen Rubin's work on the four tendencies. So I knew I'd come back to it, and I'm so pleased I did, to enable me to have this really wonderful, beautiful conversation with Alex. So thank you again, Alex, for bringing your wisdom and your stories to the show. And please do check out her Instagram for more knowledge and inspiration. And in completing series 6, this has also given me the mojo and renewed commitment to come back with series 7 in the next month. So look out for that. I'll be talking to leaders about leadership, what that means to them, having the mojo to lead, and there'll be so many takeaways for all of you listening, I know. So thank you all for your support. Thank you to all the amazing guests for their commitment. And until next time, I hope your mojo continues to flow.